This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. In the U.S. judicial system, community standards, victims' rights, and judges' discretion are all important principles. But they all collided in a spectacular way in a California case this year. College swimmer Brock Turner was found guilty on 3 felony counts of sexual assault for raping an unconscious woman at Stanford University, where he was a student at the time. The counts carried a maximum sentence of 14 years in prison, and the prosecution was asking for 6 years. The judge in the case said 6 months in jail, not prison, was fine, and further said a longer sentence would have a severe impact on the 20-year-old. The defendant's father wrote a letter seeking sympathy from the community in which he said, these are his words, that 20 minutes of action should not wipe out his son's otherwise good conduct. The community he sought to reach has been overwhelmed by outrage and condemnation from quite another community focusing on the victim. The victim wrote a letter detailing her ordeal from the rape, and that story has attracted an even larger community of sympathizers online. Sophie Karasek is the director of education for End Rape on Campus, an advocacy group she helped found in 2013. She's a survivor of sexual assault herself. Sophie says supposedly comfortable ideas about community standards from a judge are a rocky cliff when society does not have consensus, in her view, on even the definition of sexual assault, and archaic norms of sexuality, she says, persist.
What he lost was concrete, you know, titles, degrees, the ability to be on this team. But what she lost was internal, the privacy and trust and confidence and her voice and sense of self.
What do you make of the father's letter, who claims that, 20 minutes of action should not wipe out an entire life? And where's he coming from on that?
Yeah, it's completely ridiculous to make that kind of reasoning for the severity of a crime. I mean, if somebody were to shoot me in the head and kill me, would you say that they should not be held accountable for that because it only took a second to pull the trigger? You know, we should not be judging the severity of crimes based on the time that it took to commit them. Clearly, this person, this survivor, was incredibly impacted by what happened to them. And so the perpetrator of that crime needs to be held accountable for it. Again, as she so eloquently stated in her letter, we should not be learning that rape is wrong through trial and error. You need to be held accountable for it when you commit it.
Where does this father come from? I mean, what is this prevailing notion here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it speaks to the broader cultural sense that values the lives of men over the lives of women.
I mean, he's suggesting that there is a period in time when you're growing up, when you rape and, gosh, you really need to go on with your life. And, boy, you learn from those mistakes, don't you? I mean, that's kind of where he's coming from.
Yeah.
And you're laughing out of a kind of a outrage and disgust.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I watched this clip on The Onion earlier, basically saying having a similar reasoning of, you know, this poor college athlete is trying to get on with his life after he rapes somebody. You know, isn't that admirable that he's trying to move on after the rape?
Do you think that there is a responsibility here on the part of the college?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a civil rights issue to have the right to be safe on your campus and to be free from a hostile environment. That's something that you're supposed to have under Title IX, the federal gender equity law. And that's what student activists have been really trying to draw attention to over the last couple of years, is that schools need to ensure that students aren't going through these experiences of sexual assault and sexual harassment and not having the effects of that addressed and the perpetrators held accountable if they report.
What is the judge's mission here, do you think, when you look at the verdict, look at the trial, and look at the fact that the letter from the victim was entered into the court record?
Yeah, so I think that it's worth pointing out that the judge in this case actually is a former captain of the Stanford lacrosse team. And I think it would be silly to think that that didn't have some sort of impact on how he saw the perpetrator and whether he thought that he would be a threat to society. So, you know, one of the things that he said was that he thought that, you know, it would have a severe impact on him and that we should basically not be afraid that he's going to do this again. And that was something that actually really angered me, both because you know, it's completely crazy to have that type of mentality when we're resolving and trying to get justice for people. But also because I had a similar experience where my perpetrator was basically told, you know, just don't do it again. And that really is invalidating to the experience that I had.
There's also a question of if this had been a young black man, the idea that he could learn from just a short sentence is probably not going to be one that the judge would assume.
Yeah. And also the demonization of black men in our criminal justice system is very widespread. You know, there's lots of research that shows that people who are black get longer sentences. What the undercurrent of this is, well, now he doesn't get to go to the Olympics. You know, we don't get to have a rapist representing the United States at the Olympics.
Sophie Karasek is a sexual assault survivor from UC Berkeley. She's also director of education and co-founder for End Rape on Campus. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Judge Aaron Persky of the Santa Clara County Superior Court is the judge in this case, a name no one would know but for this case, which has now attracted 200,000 signatures, calling for the judge's removal and a hurried campaign to get someone to challenge him in his upcoming election, in which he's currently running unopposed. Lynn Hecht Schaffran has been studying and educating judges on how to approach sexual assault cases for decades. She's the vice president at Legal Momentum and director for the National Judicial Education Program. She says there's a tension between judges' discretion and the temptation to install mandatory minimum sentences in cases like this, taking away all discretion from judges.
Sentences are pretty much, I don't want to say fixed. There is a lot of discretion, but the notion is that more and more we have moved to sentencing guidelines across the country because there has been so much difference between what one judge and another gives for the same offense. And so usually the statutes will say this crime deserves this level of punishment, let's say between 2 and 6 years, and there's discretion within that framework for the judge to decide what to impose.
Is there an orderly procedure for revisiting this particular case?
I don't know. I actually wrote to a colleague of mine who's a prosecutor in San Diego to ask whether what I had read about California law was accurate and whether this could be taken up as an illegal sentence. What could definitely happen here is, number one, there is a move now, a formal move, to have this judge recalled. But in addition to that, this judge could be formally censured. A few years ago, a judge in California made horrendous remarks in a rape case, condemning basically the victim for failing to resist in a case where her life was at risk. And the California Commission on Judicial Discipline publicly admonished him. I have a 2-day course for judges called Understanding Sexual Violence that I have given in more than 25 states over many years. And it just happened that I was sitting behind two judges as they listened to the section on offenders. And this was a particular description of a situation in a fraternity. And I could tell from the body language of these two men that they were made very, very uncomfortable by this. And when the presenter finished, one of these two men said to the room, "Well, I don't see that there was any rape there. That's what everybody does on a Saturday night when you're in college. You go out, you get drunk, you hope you get lucky." And the judge, who was the head of judicial education in that state, looked across the room at these two men and he said, "You know, there's a difference between hope and coercion."
Why would anyone come forth if they were the victim of a sexual assault in a situation where the presumption of innocence assumes that the perpetrator is innocent or has a whole life ahead of them?
Right.
Their value is already upgraded just by the presumption of innocence. And the presumption of innocence then implies a presumed skepticism on the part of the court of the woman who is presumed to be some kind of promiscuous person. And that, of course, is always the defense. Why would you come forth in a situation like that? It is rigged against anyone accusing someone of a sexual crime.
Well, John, you have just articulated something that I don't think many people understand about the fact that in U.S. law, there is this assumption that one is innocent until proven guilty. And that works fine in most cases. But in a situation of a sexual assault where the defense is consent, and when the parties come in and they're not in equipoise, it's not as if one side has to prove its view and the other side has to prove its view. It's exactly what you said. At the beginning of the case, the assumption is that the alleged victim consented. And although allegedly, let's say, the fiction is that the defendant is on trial, in point of fact, it's the victim who's on trial. And she or he has got to, quote unquote, prove in some way, demonstrate to the satisfaction of the jury, or if it's a bench trial, to the judge, that he or she did not consent, that this person did not agree to the sexual act that was perpetrated against them. But this is a very difficult situation in the law. And we have, over the years, looked for various ways to make these cases fairer, not in the sense of undermining defendants' rights, but in the sense of having the law and the process actually reflect what happens to victims in these traumatic situations. People really need to think very carefully about our attitudes toward it, our attitudes toward victims, whether they are men or women. I mean, we forget that a lot of men are victims as well, and they are even more reluctant to come forward because they are even more likely to be disbelieved.
Lynn Hecht Schaffran has been studying and educating judges on how to approach sexual assault cases for decades. She's the vice president at Legal Momentum and director for the National Judicial Education Program. Thank you so much.
Thank you.